Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. We've been listening to stories from home and abroad about a variety of ways to celebrate the Yuletide season. In tonight's tale, a Jewish-American psychiatrist goes to visit his future in-laws in Dublin. He's hard put to understand where he fits into this large and vocal Catholic family, but as he relates later to a friend, it all became clear to him eventually.
Dear Jacob, it appears that I've just returned from my Christmas sortie to Dublin, Ireland, but really, that's only a guess. I remain seriously disoriented. I seem to be in my apartment as I write, by the window where we've talked so often. A slow, immensely silent fall of snow has just begun to fill the night here now, smothering the lights of the Jersey shore, falling lazily through the streetlight amber, falling endlessly into the black Hudson. My mind is spent utterly. Everything has an ethereal aura. I look like a bum. I do not have memories of those 3 days. I re-experience a series of bizarre tableaux. I perceive them chiefly through a haze of unprofessional, exasperated puzzlement and a new autumnal artistic melancholy. I still smell alcohol. They club me to my knees with drink. Jacob, I could not really figure one of the bastards out. They would not stop spinning. They would not stop singing. Geraldine says, "Why do you have to poke, fiddle, and feck?" Translation, to touch interferingly, at everything and everyone. Weren't they only enjoying themselves? Sure, wasn't it Christmas? But Jacob, it wasn't Christmas, it was them. $300 an hour I command from the most celebrated and committed neurotics in Manhattan, and I could not get a functional, meaningful handle on one of her people. One moment of deduced certainty would have fulfilled me. Instead, they crippled me with beauty. As I wrote you previously, I went to Dublin with Geraldine to display for her family, my prospective in-laws. I think you met her once in the early stages. Hair like polished sequoia, good teeth, great soul, tenacious mind, paradisal torso. You would remember if you had. "Relax," she told me. "They only want to look at you. And remember, these aren't your crowd from the village. The painters that won't paint, the dancers that won't dance, the birds that can sing and won't sing. Just give yourself a bit of a break out of that and relax." Geraldine had a wonderful time in Dublin, of course. She's sleeping now. When I saw her sleeping earlier, I could not rid my mind of what her father, a.k.a. Guard to Melty, the Super to Melty, Mr. to Melty, bayed at me over the endless raucous communal singing and the blaring TV. He is a detective. His eyes rove constantly like searchlights. I saw at once that they were utterly unconnected to his thoughts. He is a brute of a man, rigorously mercurial. He said, "So, I hear tell you want my young one's hand, wa? Well, you had everything else, doctor, be all accounts." And then, an unself-conscious display of dentures, a jailer's cackle. I slept through most of the flight. The passengers were clearly Irish, all right. I hazily recall great gales of mindless communal singing from various parts of the aircraft. Jingle bells and White Christmas were popular, of course, as was a positively Bavarian concoction about the one road. Serious turbulence brought me to semi-wakefulness at some point. I recall seeing an entire aisle of them, probably a family, all in desiccated Christmas party hats. They were staring wide-eyed at nothing, like snared animals as they carefully rode the jolts. I noted that while their left hands clutched glasses containing morbidly large doses of alcohol, their right hands fidgeted in the gloom under the seats. They were fingering their prayer beads. However, my experience upon touching tarmac in Dublin was particularly unique. From the rumpled, suddenly grinning ranks came an explosion of intense applause. I was close to astonishment. "Do they do that every time they touch down?" I asked Geraldine. She supposed so. "What did it mean?" I asked. Could it be that they were expressing gratitude to the pilot for essentially not killing them? She whitened her lips. If so, didn't this betray a very unusual group demeanor or picture of the group self, I mused. "Give it a rest, Theo," Geraldine said.
But surely they knew the pilot couldn't hear them anyway, I said. It was like children applauding in the movie theater. Now that's enough, Mr. Cleverality, she hissed. And at the mouth, translation, threshold, of Christmas, there appeared to be 1,000 members of her extended family waiting in a wary silence in the airport. I felt like Michael Caine in Zulu. I knew many from photographs. Geraldine is the third youngest, Jacob, in a family of 9. 9. The married members of which carry on the torch of unremitting reproduction. They had all been drinking. As I neared the group and began the ceremonial handshakes, something unusual led me to peruse the faces twice. I suspected initially that they were congenitally wall-eyed or maybe even drunker than they appeared, but then I began to accommodate the reality of the matter. They were staring in helpless fascination at my nose. Even her father, standing there in Prussian patriarchal hubris, relented momentarily in his compulsive professional scanning of the other passengers to fix speculatively on it. "And how is the man?" he asked enigmatically. "Man," I thought, "what man?" So I hung clever and wished him happy holidays. "Well, happy M holidays," they said with pure Elizabethan vowels, as they shook my hand and stared at my hooter. Many added strangely, "On fair play to you, fair play to you now." Geraldine was obliviously aglow. As she approached her father, the giant looked warily left and right, allowed a momentary emotional liquefaction, and engulfed her. I immediately sought signals of sib-jealousy among the others, but noted none, just an unusual stoic acceptance of the primary place I'd always suspected her of occupying with Mida. Outside, the peculiarly wet, piercing chill was a shock, but the atmosphere amid the airport throng of Christmas bustle and warm expectation almost dissipated it. The family poured itself into a series of illegally parked cars, and to my surprise, a large blue official police truck driven by a furtive man in a rumpled uniform who confused me deeply by exuding an aura of unrestrained criminality and stealth. Downtown Dublin on Christmas Eve called to mind the Day of the Dead in Mexico City, but without any apparent religious inhibitions. The young were everywhere. Inebriated battalions of them marched about aggressively, bawling songs. Reeling figures palmed off walls like injured running backs trying to slip tackles. There was candid drinking on the sidewalks, urination, passionate embracing, vomiting, and this inevitable, unending, frenzied singing. We drove through chilly, pungent smog in what seemed like a labyrinth in a labyrinth. We stopped outside a house where Geraldine's father stood in wait like a murderous sentry. I noticed as I hurried indoors from what was clearly serious air pollution that the house did not have a Christmas tree in its front window, as did every other house on the block. The scene inside was to become a commonplace over the next 2 days. It engulfed and drowned me. A compact strata of children and infants writhed on the floor of the kitchen like snakes in a pit. A vast, perplexing kaleidoscope of people drinking morbidly spoke at each other without listening, and there was individual and choral singing, some of it sublime and transporting. I recall through the sparkling gaiety of early drunkenness, the shady uniformed policeman suddenly throwing wide his arms and exploding into Puccini a foot from my face. And some of it was infantile, drunken dreck. And of the one song that redeemed all but me, more anon. As soon as I entered the house, I noted the curious absence of any sort of Christmas decoration. Also, there were ghostly rectangles on the papered walls where I was sure pictures had recently hung. The super Tumulty, holding an unmarked bottle of clear liquid in glasses, quickly cornered me. "A drop now, in hearty welcome," he said, and poured a huge measure. Geraldine had warned me precisely twice. "Now, don't refuse a drink or two. They'll think you're either an old oddity or an alcoholic." I drank as he did, quickly. It approximated to drinking fire. The second shot tasted, I felt, of trees, then bluish, pristine air. I said to Geraldine, "Do you guys not put up Christmas stuff in this house?" "Oh, it's gas," she said. "They don't want to, like, upset you." Upset me, I said. Well, she said, me ma told me she found out your people don't believe in Christmas. She even took down her Sacred Heart. Well, I was staggered. She sniggered. I recall then the Super Tumelty slicing professionally through the throng towards me with the bottle raised. I recall laughing recklessly. I recall kicking accidentally against the carton pushed under the tub in the bathroom and finding the pictures there. Christ in his heart, Christ in his mother, Christ with his bleeding palms. I then recall the sudden silence as I handed them with formal care to Mrs. Tumelty in the kitchen. Oh, go ahead and hang these up, I had said, according to Geraldine. Let each believe in anything, for I believe in everyone. Anyway, it's his birthday, isn't it? A storm of laughter, backslaps. Oh, I was a terrible man, an awful man. Or a great man for a nerve doctor. They wouldn't be up to me. Give us a song, have another. And then a flood of childhood regression, the encompassing smell of my father, the smell of safety, as I was carried bodily by the Super Tumelty to a dark room filled with other sleepers. No, they were coats. I woke with no hangover, but with a feeling of lightness, of intellectual potency. Then, as I remembered, I uncovered a large scab of guilt. I went forthwith to the kitchen to confront this guilt. I expressed sorrow for my behavior generally, and was immediately awash in forgiveness. How else would anyone survive there? "'Twas jet lag," gushed the singing policeman, who now wore an utterly disreputable suit. The family, I was confounded to learn, had already toured several graveyards that morning for a cheerful seasonal visit with their multitudinous dead. So, the Shinto angle. I resolved there and then to attempt to desist from any further professional evaluation. Compared to these people, Jacob, the Jews are an open book. There was a Christmas tree in the parlor, smelling like Maine and bright as Broadway. There were ridiculous Santas on the walls, Christ with his heart, Christ with palms displayed. Oy, I should be so lucky. And drunken paper streamers on the ceiling. The Super Tumelty cornered me once more, holding a teacup. Don't mind me asking you, he said, but are you allowed turkey? Isn't it the pig you're not allowed? A notable trio entered as I finished my second cup of tea. Two were clearly detectives. They wore enormous shapeless jackets and a sense of stoicism that I liked intuitively, or perhaps it was the tea about its work. The third man, a tired, shabby young man in denims, wore handcuffs. The Super Tumelty, who had been reading a newspaper in a show of furious suspicion, greeted them heartily. He then offered the young man his chair. Well, well. He left the room as the handcuffs were removed. The disreputable policeman made his way surreptitiously across the room, shook hands with the young man, spoke to him briefly, and then slyly folded money into the young man's breast pocket. I had thought initially that the young man was unwashed or badly birthmarked, but as I headed for the bathroom, I recognized the unmistakable stain of Kaposi's sarcoma on his jaded face, his neck, the back of his hand. His breathing seemed sadly labored. There and then, Jacob, there was an agreeable rediscovery of self and mission. I am proud to say that he looked just like my kind of guy. His eyes were my workshop. He could make his pain mine, if he so wished. I introduced myself as I passed. I was Theo Shrine, shrink and medical doctor. If there was anything I could do, he could ask. Well now, fair play to you, he said. I stood in acute puzzlement at the bottom of the stairs by the front door, examining a plastic object which was screwed to the wall and which seemed for all the world to be a small finger bowl. A finger bowl on the wall? A voice spoke suddenly at my ear. The stealthy policeman in the disreputable suit had materialized soundlessly there. You bless yourself with her, he said. 'Tis for holy water. I demonstrate only I've a whole lot of drink took, and I wouldn't have an Irish lock. He undid the bottom buttons of his steamboat gambler's waistcoat. He said, no doubt you know the young lad inside has the AIDS. I did, I said. Ah, he's game ball, he said, and I'll tell you why. He has a young lad of 5 years. says he to me once, "I'm happy enough, Bat. I've someone to follow me other than the drug squad." We feel for him.
The one song that redeemed all but me was called for in defense of peace as darkness gathered. The Super Tumulty had broken up a scuffle using only a magic mantra. "Ah, lads, lads, the holy season." While he had the gathering's attention, he placed a paw on his massive chest elegantly, as though about to sing. Instead, he boomed, "And now, a parting song before the bit of dinner. I call on Mr. Lucky Bork to fill the bill. Good order, please." There was an immediate tumult of urging. "Man, Lucky! More power, Lucky! Sing out, Lucky! Yes, Lucky!" Lucky, I thought, indeed. The young man seemed very drunk now, or weary. He reclined his head slightly and began to stare directly ahead with extreme avidness. I suspected he was seeing things. He was, Jacob. I know that now. He was communing with whatever transcending thing, with whatever wordless, vital cognizance that had banished his anger and filled him with a sweet acceptance. For Jacob, I heard this sweetness overflow into the waiting silence. He began to fill the room with a brown river of sound. It awed me. The intensity, the compass, was so new to me. The song flowed with the slowness innate to deep things. On Raglan Road of an autumn day, I saw her first and knew that her dark hair would weave a snare that I might one day rue. I saw the danger and I passed along the enchanted way, and I said, "Let grief be a fallen leaf at the dawning of the day." I was mesmerized, smitten, then devastated. And this, Jacob, is what abides. I could not but watch the Irish as he sang. Some closed their eyes, smiling with the pleasure of the pain of it, weeping, drinking deeply, smelling their children's hair. I did not know, and do not know now, Jacob, if this is in some way of them particularly, this faculty to bear witness to elemental sadness, this capacity to shape enigmatic acceptance into what shines and is exquisite. Geraldine was watching me. I knew she would be. She knew that I knew, that she knew, my precise anguish and yearning as I listened to Dying Lucky singing. What he poured out so sweetly into adoring silence, I was condemned to poke, fiddle, and feck for amid self-doubt, resistance, and insult. She came and kissed me. It was almost enough. Thus, old friend, the snow falls for me tonight like the shattered atoms of something I had placed high above and worshipped. I may have to go and live with them, you know, and learn to sing. Love, Theo.
David Adams read Lucky Singing by Noel MacFarlane. The story is published in An Anthology of Irish Comic Writing. The reading was produced in Vancouver by Dagmar Kafunka Nunn. Tomorrow, we start a magical tale of stories lost and found in Salman Rushdie's book, Harun and the Sea of Stories. For Between the Covers, I'm Heather Brown, inviting you to stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by Late Night Music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights.